All right, good morning. Welcome to another lecture today. And so today, so what we are actually sort of doing here is that we are building the new theory for gravitation, for gravity, which would be better than the Newtonian theory because it sort of also is consistent with special relativity and so on and so on. And so we have gone very far, just without doing any differential geometry, sort of. We have seen that we know how the particles can move. We know that the new theory will be described by a metric tensor, by metric, which is no longer a Minkowski metric, but is general curve metric. It's a matrix, 4x4 matrix, which is symmetric. So in principle, it has 10 components. And so you know, you have these 10 component object which will describe your gravitational field. So now let me just outline what we are really wanting to do for the rest of the course, where we are heading, right? And so we want to build a classical field theory for gravitational field. So now whenever you are building classical field theory, the classical field theory consists of several things. First of all, you have to identify what the field is. Right, in our case, we already know that it will be the metric tensor G mu nu. Okay, you also have to identify, you know, if you are given the field configuration, how does the matter which lives in that field respond to that field? That's called equations of motion. Okay, so if I put a particle in my gravitational field, I want to know how that particle will be moving, and that's described by equations of motion for that matter. That's the second ingredient. Finally, you may want to know, well, if I put some distribution of matter, how that distribution produces my gravitational field. Okay, that's called field equations. So every classical field theory has these three ingredients. So let me just, you know, summarize this for the most famous three classical field theories as we know them. So we have classical field theories. And let me start with the one which is the Maxwell field. So we'll have Maxwell theory. And let me draw a table here. And we will have Newton theory, Newtonian gravity. And then we will have general relativity or Einstein theory. Okay. So I said the first thing to identify is what is actually the field in your classical field theory. So the first entry will be what the field is. And of course, we know that in the Maxwell theory, the field will be either the field strength E and B, or actually a little bit more fundamentally at the quantum level, it will be the vector potential A mu. Okay, so we can do either A mu, or it will be the field strength E and V, which can be encoded in F mu nu. Right? So that's what the field in Maxwell theory is. So now in Newton, if you want to describe Newton's theory, typically people describe it as the gravitational acceleration G, but you can just get that by doing a gradient of phi of the potential. You know that the potential includes everything about the gravitational field in Newton's theory. So that will be a Newtonian potential phi. Okay, we already know what the answer for the field is for Einstein. It's just the metric G mu nu. So this is more complicated. In Maxwell, we have 4. In Newton, we have 1. In Einstein, we have typically 10. Okay, so that's what the field is. So then, what are the equations of motion for the matter if we place it in that given field, right? So what will be the equations of motion for matter in the case of Maxwell? Any suggestions? Lorentz force law, perfect. Very good. So it will be something like d p mu over d tau. It's given by the Lorentz force law, so you have charge f mu nu, and then u nu of the particle. So if the particle is moving with the velocity u nu, this is the force in a given external field f mu nu, which it experiences. So in Newton, this is even more simple. So we have the standard equation that the Newtonian equation dp over dt is the force mg, but if I plug for g minus gradient of phi, it will be minus m gradient of phi of the Newtonian potential. Okay. What is it for the Einstein theory? It's the geodesic equation that you already derived. So we already know the answer. So it will be generalization of this thing here, dx squared x mu d tau squared gamma mu alpha beta dx alpha d tau dx beta d tau equals to zero. So that's my geodesic equation. Which is how the matter moves in a given gravitational field, and the gravitational field will be captured by these Christoffel symbols, gamma over here. Okay. Finally, what we want is the field equations. Okay. And what are those? For Maxwell, is the Maxwell equation. You can write it in very many ways. You can write it again for f mu nu or for a mu. Let me just write it for a mu. It doesn't matter from the classical point of view. So for a mu is that you know that you actually get something like wave equation. And this is given by, if you have current J mu, that's what's sourcing your electromagnetic field. But of course, this equation, this wave equation here, is valid only in the Lorentz gauge, for example. So this is one way to write down the corresponding Maxwell equations. Or you can write them in terms of f mu nu, in which case it would be d mu f mu nu. Is 4 pi j nu. And then you would also have the other Maxwell equation that, you know, if you do partial derivative of f mu nu, you anti-symmetrize over all indices, you get zero. Okay, so that will be the other one. Okay. Let's just keep it this way. So now what about Newton? What do you think you get for Newton? So we want to express Newton's law in terms of the potential phi. Do you know what this potential phi satisfies in the Newton's theory? Is the it's called Poisson equation. It's a generalization of Laplace equation. So basically, Laplace square on phi is 4 pi gravitational constant g and the energy density of the matter over here. And interestingly, this thing here is basically a static limit of this equation over there. So if I have static field, right, so I have a mu, so note if this are like a mu would be like phi and then vector potential a. So now if there's nothing is moving, there's no current, so there won't be any vector potential a either. So this will be zero. So then we have only one equation here, which is a box on phi, is my, and so j mu would be rho and j, right? And so j is zero because everything is static. So then I have box on phi is 4 pi rho. But what is box? It's like d square over dt square minus lambda square or something like that. If it's static, the time derivatives are not there. So it will just be Laplace square. Okay, and so really, you know, this is, you can think about this like a static limit of the Maxwell theory, except you have now a different coupling constant. You have the gravitational coupling constant. Here you have the electromagnetic coupling constant, right? And so here is the density of matter, density of mass, or density of energy. And here is the density of charge. But otherwise, it's basically like a static limit of that, right? Okay, so now, what about Einstein? So that will be our case, our task now, to find out what will be the corresponding field equation for this, you know, generalized gravity theory. By the way, once you have the field equations, you can also start asking, and let me just put a very small cell over here, which is like how many degrees of freedom would the field itself have if there were no matter sources, or if there were no sources, okay? So in other words, what we are now asking is there a possibility at the classical level for electromagnetic waves or gravitational waves which can survive on their own without actually any sources? So now, what is the answer for Maxwell? What do you think? How many degrees of freedom do we have? We have 2 degrees of freedom, which corresponds to, I don't know, 2 polarizations of electromagnetic wave, or right? So you can have this polarization or that polarization and so on. So you have 2 degrees of freedom for electromagnetic waves. What about Newton? How many degrees of freedom do we have in Newtonian theory? Any tips? Zero. There's no waves, right? Everything is static, right? So zero. There's no gravitational waves in Newton's theory. Anybody has any tips for how many degrees of freedom we will have in Einstein's gravity? Okay, there's a proposal 3. Any other proposal? 2. What about 5? Anybody wants 5? So if you lived in 5 dimensions, that would be 5. But because we probably live in 2, in 4 dimensions, it's only 2 degrees of freedom. We shall derive this, don't worry. Okay? So we have 2 degrees of freedom, there's 2 polarizations of gravitational waves in Einstein's gravity. Okay? Very good. So now, what we basically want to do for another 2 weeks is we want to construct what these field equations for Einstein's gravity are. Okay, and we will need lots of geometry for that, but let's just make an educated guess. Okay, so what are the field equations? And let's call it educated guess. And you'll see it's very simple. So what we have already established when we were doing this Newtonian limit, so we looked at our favorite geodesic equation, and we said, well, this geodesic equation better in the Newtonian regime reduces to the Newtonian equation, right? And we've seen that that is the case if we said that GTT, so Newtonian limit, gave us limit, we land that GTT had to be equal to minus 1 minus 2 phi, where phi was the Newtonian potential. So this is what we derived by matching the 2 equations of motion, right? So very good. So in the Newtonian limit, our field equations in Einstein's gravity also better reduce to the Newtonian equation, field equations, the Poisson equation over here. So we also want that the field equations better reduce to this equation over here. Lambda square phi equals to 4 pi g row in the Newtonian limit. Right? This is what we want. Very good. But we know now that phi is just, you know, a piece of my much bigger field, which is the G mu nu, right? So this is just GTT component of that, but more generally, I will have G mu nu. Anyway, I can rewrite this equation in terms of, so that it looks almost like in terms of G mu nu. How do I do that, right? So I solve what phi is from here, and I have to apply nabla square on phi. So this thing here will be equal to minus nabla square GTT, okay? It's equal to 8 pi G, okay? So if you apply nabla square on GTT, it gives you minus 2 phi. That's why I'm putting the minus here, and there's a factor of 2. That's why I suddenly have 8 here instead of 4, right? And then I have rho. But what is rho? Well, we know from special relativity that the energy density is just the zero-zero component of the energy momentum tensor, T mu nu, okay? So what this really is 8 pi g t tt, the energy momentum tensor over here. So far, I've just been rewriting the Newton's equation in terms of the new variables, in terms of the G mu nu variable, and in terms of the energy momentum tensor, T mu nu. This is just the Newton's equation, but written in a new fashion, right? Okay, so now it's very natural that, you know, this is just one equation. Well, if we are to replace gravitational field with G mu nu, we expect, well, there's 10 components for G mu nu. Shouldn't we get 10 equations? It's very natural that this equation should somehow generalized to something which acts on the full G mu nu. So there will be 10 equations, and then there will be the full T mu nu on the right hand side. So the guess would be that our equation reads 8 pi g t mu nu equals to the generalization of the left-hand side into the g mu nu. Okay, so this, there will be some operator acting on my metric g mu nu. Okay, what kind of operator I can have? The operator, well, here I have second derivatives of the metric. Right, so that would be, the operator certainly will have second derivatives, but in principle it can have also first derivatives, and it can also depend on the metric, right? Let's call such an operator capital G mu nu. Why not? Okay, let's call it capital G mu nu. And this capital G mu nu will, as we said, depend on two derivatives of the metric, principle on the first derivative of the metric, and on the metric itself. So this is our educated guess for as to how our Newtonian equations have to generalize to our new field theory. Okay, so this is, everybody happy so far? There's one more ingredient which tells you what this G mu nu is. Okay, so then what do you know about T mu nu? Right, so in special relativity, T mu nu is conserved, which means partial mu T mu nu equals to zero. Okay, that's a conservation equation. In general relativity, this directly generalizes, except instead of partial mu, you have to use slightly different derivative. Okay, so let's say we know, not really, we are already generalizing a little bit special relativity, but only a little bit, from special relativity, that the energy momentum tensor better be conserved. Okay, so instead of partial mu t mu nu equal to zero, I'm writing some different derivative, okay? Slightly more general derivative. you will learn what the derivative is just next week, at the beginning of next week. Okay? So we know that this has to be true. Okay, very good. But if this has to be true, then how can this equation be consistent? So let's say I take this equation here, and I apply nabla mu on it. Okay? So if I apply nabla mu on it, the left-hand side is zero. Nabla mu t mu is zero. Okay, I can write the index if you want. Let's make it this way. So now I can apply nabla mu. Okay? So nabla mu t minus is zero. Well, this equation is only consistent if the right-hand side is also zero. So consistency then implies that also nabla mu t mu nu has to be equal to zero. Okay? That's what's required by consistency of this equation. So very good. So now the question is, what kind of G mu I can have here? And that's not a question for a physicist. It's a question for a mathematician. Okay, I can ask my friend, who is a mathematician, okay, I want the most general G mu nu, which is composed of second derivative, first derivative, and of the metric itself, so that for any metric, this will be true. Okay, and your friend mathematician will look it up or will actually do some calculation, and he will tell you, well, you're very lucky there's only one such G mu nu. Okay, so this determines G mu nu uniquely. Four dimensions. Such G mu nu will be an Einstein tensor. G mu nu is called Einstein tensor. And there is only one such Einstein tensor constructed out of second derivatives of the metric, first derivatives of the metric, and metric itself. There is nothing else. Well, I'm cheating. The answer is, it is the Einstein tensor plus an arbitrary combination, one parametric generalization of this, plus metric. Okay, that's the only freedom you have. You can add the metric itself with an arbitrary coefficient. In four dimensions, okay? So this is in 4D. Let's believe we live in 4D for the moment, okay? This may not be true, but let's pretend it is. Okay, so we're done. We just derived Einstein equations, and the Einstein field equations are really that G mu nu. Let me call that freedom alpha something else. Let me call it lambda. Why not? Okay, plus lambda G mu nu equals to 8 pi g g mu nu. These are the Einstein equations. What is this freedom lambda here? It's a cosmological constant. Right? And it is a constant. It's not a function. It's really a number. Okay? It is a constant. Yes?
What was the reason that you added G mu nu?
Oh, so what I will show you, and you will see it next week, is that, well, what you want is that you are looking for the most general G mu nu, such that, okay, let me call it G mu nu tilde, okay, such that nabla mu G mu nu equals to zero. The question is, what is that? Okay? And the answer is, the most general G mu nu tilde, which satisfies this equation, is the Einstein tensor plus constant times the metric itself. Okay. Sorry, I misused the notation, so I should have called it G mu nu tilde. Okay? Right? So there is this freedom here. Well, this is sort of trivial freedom. Okay? The metric, as you will see, we always impose that the metric, actually the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. Okay? We always impose that. So this is sort of a trivial piece. So that's why I call it originally G mu. The statement is like, what is the most general G mu tilde? And the answer is the most general G mu tilde, which satisfies that equation, is the Einstein tensor plus constant times the metric itself.
Okay.
And so we derive the Einstein equation. Which one? The lambda?
Yeah.
Not quite. No. This is certainly has physical effect. It's causing the acceleration of our universe and stuff like that. It is an extra parameter which you can introduce into description of, you know, of physics. Right? It's an extra parameter. And if you want to, you know, derive it from the action principle, this parameter will be contained in the action, and it's really a parameter describing your theory. Okay. But what is really important is that it's a constant. It's a constant. It has to be, lambda has to be a constant. It's not a function of x. It's a constant. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Okay. And so we have Einstein equations. And so for the next three lectures or so, we will try to, you know, we will aim at understanding, you know, why there is this only, you know, this is the only possibility, and, you know, what are we really doing here? But that's the answer. Yes, there's a question.
Yeah, so perhaps could I add something like a prototype that has some anti-symmetric tensor? Sorry.
No, because this thing here, as you know from special relativity, is symmetric. Oh, you mean divergence and symmetric anti-symmetric in those ways? Yes, you could probably. Okay, let me think about that. Okay, let me think about that. Okay, so anyway, we have Einstein equations. So in case of Einstein, of course, his friend who was a mathematician was Grossmann, and he helped him to actually understand differential geometry. And then, you know, once Einstein understood differential geometry, he could find this solution here, and he had his answer, he had his field equations. Okay. Questions? Yes?
So you're assuming that the small g mu nu is, if you take the derivative with using the...
It's not blah, yeah.
It's just zero,
exactly. So in that case, both things will be independently zero. So this will be zero, and that will be also zero. Yeah,
thanks.
All right, so now let's dive into differential geometry. So part two, chapter two, will be geometric tools. And so you will discuss what the manifolds are, what the tensors are, what the metric really is, what this nabla mu is, and what this Einstein tensor is, okay? So let me start with the manifolds. So part A will be manifolds. So now I'll draw a picture of a manifold. So it looks like this thing over here, for example. It can have some smooth holes if you want and stuff like that. It's a very, very abstract object. But what is very super nice about this object is that always locally, if I restrict to some neighborhood of some point, it will look like R to the M. It will look like the multidimensional vector space you know from multidimensional calculus. Okay, so it's so it has a local structure of R to the n, where n is some number. If you have n-dimensional manifold, then R to the n. But not necessarily. Its global properties. Okay, so that's what a manifold is. And so now I'll give you a formal definition And then I will try to explain what this definition means. Okay, let me start writing here. So we have definition. An dimensional manifold M. And so please don't laugh at me if you are mathematically minded. So I will not use the most general definition, the abstract one with topological spaces and stuff like that. I will use the physics version of it, okay? So we will talk about points and stuff like that. And of course, if you are a mathematician, you will crucify me here, okay? So be gentle. We are physicists, okay? So manifold M is a set of points. If you want to find more general definition, please look it up in Wikipedia or whatever. Together with a collection of subsets, let's call them O alpha, satisfying, and there will be three conditions. So let's call one such point P, right? So that will be my it'll be a set of points, manifold be a set of points P. So let's take that one point and let's call it P, right? And so each point in that manifold matter lies in one of these subsets of alpha. Okay, so first condition is each point P, which belongs to that manifold, lies in at least one of these subsets of alpha, at least one of alpha. Which means, like, these O alpha, they cover the whole manifold, right? So I cannot find any point on the manifold which wouldn't belong to any of these subsets. So the subsets O alpha, they cover manifold, the whole manifold. Okay, so in other words, O alpha cover M. Okay? Very good. So each of these points in the manifold belongs to some subset of alpha. Second, for each alpha, there is one to one map psi alpha, which goes from this O alpha to a subregion U alpha. So where U alpha is an open subset of R to the N. Okay, so what does it mean? Okay, so what it means is that I have my point P here. Know that point P has to belong to this region O alpha. Okay, there must be at least one such O alpha for which it belongs. And then my manifold structure is equipped that there exists a map from this region O alpha, let's call it psi alpha, to an open subset of R to the N. So I have now my favorite R to the N. And then this map goes, maps this O alpha into the region, the subset of R to the N. Okay? So what it basically means is that the neighborhood of P looks like a subset of R to the N. It locally looks like R to the N. Okay? So this is a nice map. It's one to one, it's onto, and it basically tells me the neighborhood of P looks like locally like R to the N. Okay. Finally, let's complicate the situation a little bit. Yes?
What is exactly the structure of
It doesn't have a boundary, basically. Yeah, it's like an open ball, which doesn't have. Yeah, because, you know, if you deal, so if you have a manifold, you can have manifolds with boundaries, right? But then you have to deal with the boundary itself separately. So at this point, we have no boundaries, we have just.
No, when it doesn't have a boundary, how do you specify it from the other points of the space? I mean, I don't think that it doesn't have a boundary, but you said that U alpha is an open subset. So, the other parts of space other than U alpha is not in U alpha, but there's no boundary that can distinguish U alpha from other parts of the space. I mean.
No, it's just, you know, I can. Well, I don't know. It's really like I'm not trying to deal at this point with manifolds with boundaries. Okay, in that case, the manifold, the simplest manifold you can think about is the surface of the sphere, for example, right? So think about the surface of the sphere. It doesn't have any boundary. I can go around in all the directions. And then the question is, like, I take the point on that on the surface of the sphere and look how it looks in the neighborhood of the point. And the statement is, it has the same dimensionality as R to the N, sort of. I can, very intuitively, I have the same dimension. And I can map, you know, the neighborhood region of that point on that sphere into, you know, something which looks, you know, some subset of R to the N. Does it make sense? So if you have the boundary, you have to do something more. But let's not in this course, no boundaries, okay? Well, that's not true, but almost true. Okay, so very good. So that's the second point. The third point is that I told you that there are these, you know, each P lies in at least one O alpha. But what happens if it actually lies in two O alphas, right? So I may have O alpha here, but I may have a different subset. Let's call it O beta. Okay, and the P belongs to both. Okay, so then what happens next? So if any two sets O alpha and O beta overlap, that is O alpha O beta is not equal to zero, then maps, let me write it, psi beta composed with psi alpha inverse is nice and smooth, is C infinity. Okay? Again, you can deal with manifolds which are not infinitely smooth, but let's not do that. Let's yeah, in physics, everything is infinitely differentiable. Right, so everything is very, very continuous and smooth and nice. So what is this thing here, right? So remember, so we have our point P, it belongs to O alpha. This O alpha is actually this its own map, psi alpha, which maps it over here, okay? Then, it also belongs to O beta. The O beta comes with its own map, psi beta, which maps it to some region nu beta over here. Okay. So now there is an overlap of the two regions, which is this one here. Okay. Well, that will correspond to, well, this is my U alpha. That will correspond to something like maybe this piece here. Okay. So it'll be a subset of that U alpha. Similarly, there will be this thing here, which will be a subset of this thing here. So this is where, you know, the two things overlap. This is where the two things overlap. So now what is the map? So now we talk about psi alpha minus 1. What is psi alpha minus 1 doing? It goes from this region over here back to the manifold, to the region here. And then I compose it with psi beta. So what this psi alpha minus 1, psi alpha minus 1, composed with psi beta is doing is that it takes me from here to here. Right? But isn't this beautiful? Because, well, it talks about something interesting of the manifold, but what this map really is a map from R to the N to R to the N. So you know everything about multidimensional calculus. You know how the functions, which map, you know, from vectors in R to the N to vectors R to the N. What does it mean that they are smooth, that they are first, that they have first derivative differentiable, and so on? So this thing, so what you require, so this is just a normal map, as you know it from second year calculus, from R to the N to R to the N. And you require that this thing is nice and smooth. Okay, so that's the condition. Okay, very good. So that's what you require in the third requirement. It sort of tells you how nice and smooth the manifold is over here. But you don't need to know about manifold. You just need to know how to do calculus in R to the N. So that's what's beautiful about manifolds. You basically, all the time, you talk about this abstract manifold, abstract object, but you translate everything into the properties of R to the N. Because you have these charts which take you from the manifold to R to the N. Okay? Everybody happy? So now, yes?
Will this map also be invertible?
What do you think?
I think so.
Well, yes, it better be. So I can definitely invert psi beta to minus 1 and then use psi alpha to put it back. So it will also be invertible, of course. There's no reason why I should prefer alpha over beta, right? Or beta over alpha. It's invertible. And that's also, you know, given by that it's onto and stuff like that, 1-to-1 and onto. These maps are 1-to-1 and onto. So that's why they are invertible. Okay. So now, so this is the definition, mathematical definition. But of course, physicists like to talk about various coordinate systems, right? And so maybe they prefer, you know, these coordinates in R to the N. They call them X. So I have a coordinate system X. And maybe they call this one X prime. So what you are really describing here, what this map here, from here to there is, is there really a coordinate transformation from x to x prime? So this is how x looks in terms of x prime. It's a coordinate transformation. Okay. So in other words, what you are really, you know, doing is that you are saying, well, I can use various coordinate systems to describe, you know, what's happening on the manifold, and, you know, the transition between the coordinate systems better be nice. Sometimes it is nice, sometimes it is not nice. As we have seen yesterday in the Windler case, some coordinate systems may cover the whole manifold. For example, in the Minkowski case, we had a coordinate system, the standard Minkowski coordinate system, which covered the entire manifold, right? It was the whole Minkowski space. But then we had a different coordinate system, which was the Rinder coordinate system, which covered only part of that manifold, this one quarter, region one, right? So now the two coordinate systems, well, nicely connected, as long as you were not on the horizon. On the horizon, the Rinder coordinate system did break down, Okay, so there was a finite validity to that coordinate system, to the VM, the coordinate system. Okay, so basically, manifold is like, so the general manifold cannot be covered typically by one coordinate system, but there will be many more coordinate systems, and but it's guaranteed that the whole manifold will be covered by all these coordinates. Okay, questions? Okay, so now stupid quiz. So let me draw some object. So we have the sphere as two. We have this thing here where we identify this with that, and this with that. And we have a cone like this, which the surface of the cone, you identify this with that, and this with that. Do you know how that is called?
Torus.
Torus, T2. Which of these is a manifold? Which of these looks locally like R to the N? Not necessarily globally, but locally, R to the N is nice and smooth. So who thinks the first one is a manifold? Please raise your hand. Yeah, exercise. Okay, very good. So indeed, this is a manifold. What about T2? Perfect. What about this thing? Where does it break?
At the intersection.
Exactly. There's this tip between the two. And so this is a problem. And so this will not be a manifold. Okay? Very good. Very good. Minkowski spacetime is a manifold, right? So we understand manifolds. It's that simple. So now the next thing is, can we equip our manifolds with some additional structures? So one very important structure is a scalar function. Okay. Let's call it F. So scalar function f maps the points on the manifold to real numbers. Okay. So how does it do it? So again, this is my manifold over here. I have this point p, and I want to define what f of p is. Okay. It will be some number, which I simply assign to, like, you know, what this scalar function gives me at that point P. It gives me some real number, 5, 10, whatever, for the given P. For different P, it will give me something else, right? But what do I require, again, if I have, you know, these coordinate systems? So if I have one coordinate system here, coordinate system X, then there will be this F of X of P. So there's this psi map, which maps me to a coordinate system X. And so I will have, like, when I map it over here, that will be this X of P here. And it assigns me number F of X of P. So I can go first to the coordinate system. I have x of p, and then the function better gives me 5 again on that f of x of p. I can do it for a different coordinate system. X prime, so there will be the point x prime of p here. So it will give me a number here, f prime of p. What is that number going to be? If it is 5 over here, what is it over here? 6. You want that your function is independent of the choice of the coordinate system. You really want to describe, you know, like, given the point on the manifold, It gives me a number. That number has to be independent of, you know, what kind of coordinate system I am using to describe the neighborhood of my point. Right? So it has to be equal to f prime x prime of p. Otherwise, it's not coordinate system independent. Right? It has to give me the same number. What I really want to describe is what is f of p. It doesn't matter which coordinate system I used to describe the neighborhood of p. Right? So this thing here often is simply written as that f of x is equal to f prime of x prime. Okay? That's the transformation rule for your scalar function. Okay? If I'm using different coordinate system x prime, I'm still talking about the same function, the same real point on the manifold, and just using different coordinate systems to describe it. This is the transformation rule, how the scalars have to transform under change of coordinates. Does it make sense? So this has to be independent of coordinate system. Questions? Yes? So, you have point P, you have its neighborhood, which is this O alpha here. There's a map, psi, which maps it to R to the n. Okay? Let me call the coordinate system in that R to the n x. So what that x of P is really is the coordinate which you assign to the point P. Okay, so let's say I'm using Cartesian coordinates, in the, and so I assign to that point P, t equals to 1, x equals to 5, y equals to 0, z equals to something. So that will be, you know, my description of that point P in that coordinate system, right? However, I can also do it with a different coordinate system, x prime. But you know, the value of the function cannot depend on what kind of coordinate system I'm using. I just want that for a given point of in the manifold P, I'm assigned one unique number, right? Independent of the coordinate system I'm using. Does it answer the question? Yes?
Can we think of f x of p is equal to psi of p?
Very good. Thank you so much. So I am mixing here two notations, right? I am mixing the mathematical notation with psi with the physics notations of x, right? So I think there's like, you could say that psi is x or something.
So what's f prime in this? Mm-hmm.
So you may want to put the prime here or not. People typically put the prime, but what they simply mean is that now I talk about a function f in the coordinate system x prime. And people typically put the prime there just to know that now I'm talking about the x prime system.
It's the same function. Right?
It's the same function. It's the same function. So okay, let's not put it there. Okay, so very good. This is the physics notation people typically use. F of x is f prime of x prime, but we are talking about the same function. You're exactly right. It's just that it's the same function in a different coordinate system.
Yeah, technically, it's a function from a different space has the same domain, but it's from a different space. So I think that's why.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. All right. Let me now do a little bit more complicated thing, but not really. Is that there's also maps between manifolds. Okay. So maps between manifolds. So you can basically map some, you know, let's say, so this was a function which mapped a manifold to real numbers, if you want. So real number is also a manifold. The line of real numbers is also a manifold. But then you can do more generally, you can have manifold M, and you can do a mapping to some new manifold M prime. And again, the way how you do it is that basically you go to the R to the N, and there's your corresponding map psi, and this manifold need not have the same dimension as we have seen here already, right? So I can start with an n-dimensional manifold here, go to one-dimensional real number manifold. So let's call it R to the M, where M need not be equal to N, right? And that will be the corresponding psi prime. So now again, what you require is, you know, this map maps point P here to point Q there, right? So how do you define that? Again, you use a map from R to the N, the map from here to there. Okay, how do you do that? So what is this map? Is first, you map over here. So you do psi minus 1. You go from here to there. Then you compose it with the map F. And then you go from here to there. Okay, so that's your map. It goes from R to the N to R to the M. Again, you know everything about these types of maps. And you require that this map is nice and you know, think. So for example, so there's a very important subset of these maps, and that's called a diffeomorphism. Okay, so for example, which is called diffeomorphism. So it's such a map, F M to M prime, such that it is infinitely differentiable. So again, basically this thing here to that thing here is infinitely differentiable, is 1 to 1, is onto, and also the inverse is infinitely differentiable. Okay, so it's a very, very special map, where you basically have like maps going both ways. These maps are infinitely differentiable. Now, 1 to 1, they are onto. Okay. What do you think has to happen when you have that type of map? Can this map be really from R to the N to R to the M, where M is not equal to N? What do you think? Can I have a map from a sphere to a line which would satisfy these properties?
No.
The manifolds have to have the same dimensions, okay? In fact, they have to have the same manifold structure. They are basically the same manifold. Okay, if you have diffeomorphism, then you can say that from here, it implies that M and M prime have the same or identical manifold structure. What does that mean? Well, whatever that means, it basically means that you can think about M and M prime as one manifold. They are basically the same manifold. And what this diffeomorphism is doing is mapping the points from that manifold to some different points on that same manifold. Okay? So that's what diffeomorphism is doing. So that's people doing GR like the word diffeomorphism, It really corresponds to some kind of coordinate transformation from, you know, one coordinate system in the manifold to another one. There's two points of view. One is active one, where you really send the space-time points of that manifold to some different space-time points of that manifold. Or, in fact, you can just say, I'm just changing coordinate system. That's the passive point of view, and they can be shown to be equivalent. So anyway, diffeomorphism is just map, basically, from one manifold to the same type of manifold. Okay. So now a question to you. Do you want 3-minute break? Who wants 3-minute break? Okay, let's have 3-minute break. So we can put scalar functions on the manifold. And, you know, an example of a scalar function, well, not really, but let's say I have Earth, that's my manifold, and then I measure temperature in each point, on Earth, and the temperature could be the scalar which I assign to Earth, right? So that's an example. So now we can have different things. We can put also other objects on Earth. For example, we can put lakes, and we can put rivers. Okay, so correspondingly, we will describe curves on the manifold and some, you know, two-dimensional subsets, surfaces. Okay, so another object which we can put is a curve gamma on the manifold M is a map from some region I, or some interval I, which is a subset of R1 to M. Such that if you compose again your maps which you have, so psi composed with gamma, and to evaluate that on the parameter t, which characterizes your region I, so this thing here brings you again to R to the n. So then you have like n numbers describing your curve, and they will be parameterized by this coordinate t. So we'll have x1 of t, x2 of t, x3 of t, and so on. So this thing here is nice and smooth. Is smooth. Okay. So again, let me draw a picture what this means. So this is my manifold. And I want to make sense of, you know, what a curve on that manifold could be. Okay? So how you do that is that you say, well, you get that curve on that manifold as a map gamma, which goes from R1, then some subregion of R1, I, and you parameterize that thing here by some parameter t. So for given t, I will know where on that R1 I am. Let's say it's a time parameterizing my R1 region. T is 1 here, T 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. So now there's a map which maps from here to the manifold. Well, that's abstract, so I use my map psi to map this to R to the n, and it will give me a curve in R to the n, and the curve in R to the n in the coordinate system x is simply described by one, x1 of t, x2 of t, and so on, right? So this is what gamma of t is. And again, when you are saying it's smooth, what you really mean is that the map from R1 directly to R to the n, which is gamma composed with psi, is nice and smooth. Super simple. Always using these maps, which your manifold is equipped with, to map things from R to R to some power. Okay? So this is psi composed with gamma. And that's nice and smooth. Of course, you know, this is nothing that you have been doing for all time, right? In special relativity, if you want to describe the motion of the particle, right? So the motion of the particle is some kind of curve, gamma, and you describe it in terms of saying what you know, okay, what t of some parameter is, well, let's not use t, well, x0, xi, so then I have x0 of t, x1 of t, x2 of t, and so on. So this is how you would describe the trajectory of a particle in special relativity, right? You just parameterize your curve by some parameter. That's precisely the parameter which lives here in R1. And then, you know, this is some nice smooth function here, okay? You are very familiar with this. So similarly, you can do surface. Well, the logic is exactly the same. Now you have 2D surface, let's say. So you want to describe a lake on the manifold. And so 2D surface is simply something which is, instead of one-dimensional, it will be two-dimensional. We have a surface as is a map as from now two-dimensional subregion of R2 to M, such that psi composed this S. And so now this thing here, because we are two-dimensional, will depend on two parameters, right? So before I was choosing t, or maybe I should have been using tau, doesn't matter. So now let's use two parameters, let's call them tau and sigma. Why not? Okay, tau and sigma. And it's a map that where I express x1 as tau and sigma, x2 as tau and sigma, and so on. And again, this must be nice and smooth. So again, the picture would be, that's your manifold. Now you want to describe something like this. This is your surface S. And how you do that is that it's a map S from now a two-dimensional subset of R2 . So this is your U, and you parameterize R2 with two coordinates, let's say tau and sigma, here. You map it to the manifold, then you map it with psi to R to the N, where you have your thing here, so that the map from here to there is nice and smooth. So now this is very important for people who love string theory. Have you seen the Nambu-Goto action in the classical physics course, or not really? You haven't, okay. So anyway, so you see that, you know, you have a curve if you have a one-dimensional object, right? So I have a point particle here, and this point particle, as it evolves in time, it sweeps a one-dimensional thing, it sweeps a curve. So now, if you have a string, right? So this is your string. So now you evolve in time, and obviously the string sweeps a two-dimensional surface. Okay, so that's an example. That surface is called worksheet. For particle, it's called word line, as you know it. And so this is very important for string theory. Okay, that would be an example of a two-dimensional surface in our world. Questions? No questions. Isn't this amazing and simple? Super simple, right? Okay, so maybe let me finish. Are there any questions, by the way? Are there any questions so far? So let me finish now. So very good. So we have manifolds. We can put some rivers on the manifolds. We can put some lakes on the manifolds. But we would also like to describe some other physics. And for that, we will need to talk about some invariant objects on these manifolds. One of them, for example, is the scale function. That's an invariant object. Doesn't matter which coordinate system I am using. A scale function always gives me the same number. But maybe I can consider a vector or a tensor living on the manifold. And that better also be an invariant object, independent of the coordinate system. Okay, so part B. So we have part A was manifolds, part B is tensors. We know that we need tensors to describe physics. And what tensors are invariant objects. Objects that can live on manifold. Okay. And so what invariant means, let's stress that, is that really the tensor itself doesn't matter on which coordinate system I am using. It's something which is there, and it's not changing if I look at it from one coordinate system or another coordinate system. Imagine a vector, right? Vector, maybe my piece of hand is a vector, right? So this is the vector which is sitting here. Okay? It doesn't matter if I use Cartesian coordinates or spherical coordinates or any other coordinates to describe this, the vector sits here and it's this invariant object there. Okay, so that's what tensors are. Yeah, invariant objects. So an example would be a tangent vector Okay, and so what is a tangent vector, right? So let's say I am using, well, tangent vector is this thing here. This was my hand before. So now you can use some coordinate system to describe how it looks like, right? So I can use coordinates x1 and x2 to describe this tangent vector. And then typically people would write, so let's call this vector v. And it's at this point or whatever. So I have a point here, and then I describe this vector here. And so what typically people write on high school is that they will say, okay, I'm working in my Cartesian coordinate system, always, right? Always. So then I describe my vector with the corresponding components. That'll be v1, v2, v3. Right? So that's what they do. And what they sort of automatically assume is that this is in Cartesian frame coordinate system. So they always assume that, you know, these axes are perpendicular or whatever. So x1, there's x, y, z coordinates, right? And so these are just the components of the vector in that frame. Are the components. Okay. So now, of course, you are not restricted to use only Cartesian coordinate system, right? So I could use spherical coordinates, or I could use rotating coordinates, or I could use any other coordinates, right? And so then this bracket notation is very stupid, because then you would have to say, well, you would have to say this is Cartesian basis or the Cartesian coordinate system, and then you would say some other coordinate system, and you would say another coordinate system, right? And you can still describe it by components of the vector in a given coordinate system. But what is much better is to keep that information, what kind of coordinate system you are describing, directly in the description of the vector, right? So what does that actually, what does this thing here means? It means I have a direction d over dx1, okay? So it's like x1 is changing in this way. So there's this direction here. And what this v1 tells me is how much I am moving in this direction d over dx1. I have another direction d over dx2, okay? And then what v2 is telling me is how much I'm moving in that direction there. Okay, so I can definitely equally write that v is like v1 d over dx1 plus v2 d over dx2 plus v3 d over dx3. So this thing here tells me I am moving in the x2 direction. This thing here tells me I am moving in the x1 direction, and so on. And the components of the vector tell me how much I'm moving in that direction, how much I'm moving in the direction x1, how much I'm moving in the direction x2, how much I'm moving in the direction x3. Right? But when I use this description here, I don't need to use Cartesian coordinates. I can use any coordinate system I want. That would be the corresponding d over dx mu thing, right? Which tells me I am moving now along this coordinate, whatever that coordinate is, and that will be my component. So more generally, this can generalize as v mu d over dx mu, or this is any coordinate system, any coordinate system. Okay. And so these things here will be the components as we know them in that coordinate system. And this thing here tells me like in which direction I'm moving along my coordinates. And that's called basis. Okay. So before we had Cartesian basis. But we can have any other basis. So more generally, this is a better notation for vectors, because now I'm not restricted to use Cartesian coordinates. I can use any coordinates. There will be the corresponding basis associated with these coordinates. And then I can write the vector as the v mu dx, the d over dx mu. Okay, so far everybody happy? Okay, but I use this very strange notation, d over dx mu. Well, it looks like a differentiation, doesn't it? So what this actually is sort of is that I am now saying, well, I have associated my vector with a directional derivative, v mu d over dx mu. Now I can understand it as an operator. So there is an operator v hat, which is v mu d over dx mu, where I really understand this as a derivative. So this is a directional derivative. This is a derivative along my coordinate. This is the corresponding component, how much I move along that. So what this really is like, I am doing a derivative along the vector v mu. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the vectors and the corresponding operators, the corresponding directional derivatives. It's this one-to-one correspondence which is used for defining what a vector on the manifold is. Okay. Questions? So let me finish with a definition. So basically, the idea is let's use the letter thing, the derivative thing, as a definition of a vector. Okay. So now, what is a derivative, right? So derivative is something which satisfies, for example, the Leibniz rule. Because it's a first derivative, it's linear. Which are the properties of the vector? You want the vectors to be, you want to be able to add vectors. They have to form a linear space. Because it's a derivative, they satisfy some kind of Leibniz rule and so on. Okay. What is also nice about this, you know, this thing here is that what is this directional derivative doing? If I take a function and apply this thing here on a function, what do I get? If I'm at a point, right? I do some operation to find function. I do a df over dx. At that point, gives me a number. Okay, so vector will be something which eats functions and gives a number. Okay, so let me write the definition for you so that we have somewhere to start next week. All right, so definition. Let, what the hell is this letter? Anyway, be a collection of C infinity functions. Okay, then a tangent vector v at point P on the manifold P, which belongs to M, is a map which maps these functions into real numbers. So it's assigned to a function, this derivative of the function, which at a given point is a number. So it eats a function, produces a number, such that, that is first linear. Well, derivatives are linear. So if you have v af plus b g, where a is a number, b is a number, f is a function, g is a function, it will be a times v of f plus b times b of g. Okay, so it's a linear thing. While vectors better, this is like I am able to sum vectors, I'll get a new vector. And second, it is a derivative, and so it satisfies a Leibniz rule. Leibniz, so v of the product of f of g is v of f, g evaluated at p, and plus v of g f evaluated at p. And that's what a vector, very abstract definition of a vector is. Okay, so let me finish here. I will return back to this definition next week, but you already see how simple it is to define vectors in an abstract way. Questions? All right.